This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
And I am Zach Moore. And believe it or not, we're back, both back for the second consecutive week, which is a change of pace in recent weeks here. So it's fun to just be you and I here, Senior Chief. And we've got another strong topic to discuss today. But before we do, we have some letters to catch up on from our listeners.
Yeah, we appreciate the active engagement we get from the Standard Orbit team. And I've been saying we've received positive feedback and some critical ones, and since the negative message from Mr. Wright has aged a bit, I'll ask to start with that one.
Yeah, so this message is from David Wright, sent us an email. His message says, "Quite disappointed. I was listening to your review of Star Trek 2009, and I couldn't believe how much fluff and irrelevancies. Your attempt at film criticism seems to be how, quote, believable or even consistency of the elements of the film are. But what is important is themes, ideas, character development, and how the movie's elements deal with these. I'm about halfway through your podcast, and there is very little real discussion about this. Also, a lot of generalizations and broad, unsupported abstractions. I would urge you to listen to the Now Playing podcast. I think they edit a lot of this fluff out. I think with your knowledge of Trek, you could vastly improve on that. My take on 2009 is that it is barely Star Trek. Instead of a human drama, it is an action movie with several interesting character moments. Take out the nostalgia, and you have a pretty weak story of an irresponsible, reckless young man learning responsibility because, well, action sequence." So what are your thoughts on that, Ken?
I guess I can't argue it, but we're not movie critics per se. But it's one of those things where I think that any criticism, you can kind of take the good out of it. There's a feel to that message, you know, of actually being angry, which, you know, it's a podcast. And I do know I can hear sensitive subjects, like people get political and stuff, and then I can tend to get upset, which is why I steer 100% away from politics. But when it comes to whether or not we did a review show well enough or what we could do better, I think there's some things in there that's probably true that we could learn from. And then there's some other things that's like, we intentionally try to keep it light. We try to focus on the things. I think we have a very different opinion on Star Trek 09, by the way. I think it's a great movie, and I think it's one of the best Star Treks out there, and some of the best scenes in Star Trek history, or one of them anyway. That opening scene is probably one of the best I've ever seen. So,
agreed.
You know, I do disagree on his feel and thoughts about Trek 09, and I know there's a lot of criticisms about the Kelvin universe, but one thing I cannot deny at all, I don't think anybody can, is that it did reinvigorate the franchise and brought a lot of new fans into it. So I think it's good there. But Mr. Wright, we appreciate you taking the time to send us a note and for us to kind of digest what you're saying about it and the recommendations, because if we can review something and we can enhance our abilities, we'll do that. What do you think, Zach?
Yeah, I would say, David, if you looks like you wrote that email when you were halfway through the podcast, if you want to finish listening to the whole thing, and then let us know what you think at that point. I'd be interested to know. Maybe we redeemed ourselves there at the end.
Maybe.
But yeah, I mean, you know, we have a lot of feedback here. And like you said, we take the good with the bad. So, you know, everybody has different points of view. And something like Star Trek 09, it does seem to be rather polarizing in fandom. I mean, you and I both love it, Ken. And, you know, some people don't. So some people have a different idea of what, you know, their Star Trek is, and that's all well and good. I think, you know, much like, you know, people's ideas of what Star Trek is, you know, people's conversations about Star Trek can be different as well. Because with something like, you know, the Kelvin timeline, it's the current Star Trek going on right now. We're going to talk about it all the time. So I always feel like, you know, if we miss an angle one time when we talk about it, we'll probably hit it the next time we talk about it. So it's a long journey of conversation here. And I feel like over the course of the podcast, we'll hit on all the angles that are possible and that we need to talking about these specific subjects. So that's my take.
Yeah, no, that's good, Zach. I think the other thing that we do, well, first of all, you have another podcast, right? Always Smallville. And we listen to a lot of other podcasts. And I listen very critically, not to judge the caliber of the podcast, but what can we do better? How can we, you know, take maybe a method or a style or an approach that can be interesting? So I think we learn from each other listening to other podcasts. So one thing I do like is when people are critical of something, they offer a solution. And in this case, he did. Hey, try it. Check out this and see how they did it. See if it fits for you. I don't think it's going to make us go more towards movie criticism and that type of stuff, as we are, I think, more into the philosophical approach of Star Trek or the different plot lines in this. And then we've said intentionally, and we want to kind of keep it light in these heavy times to a certain degree. But I appreciate the note, and we can move on if you're ready.
Yeah, let's move on. Our next email is from Rebecca Skipper. I actually happened to walk into my parents' family room and hear this scene from Madam Secretary. I do not watch this show. At first, I thought the characters were insulting my favorite franchise, but now I get it. Please see. And she sent us a link with a little quote here from a TV fanatic, and it's from Madam Secretary. Apparently, two of the characters are having a conversation, and one of them says, "Here's a novel idea. Stick to the Prime Directive. Let democracy take its course without U.S. interference." And the other character says, "Really? A Star Trek reference?" So, see, a little cute moment from Madam Secretary there. And you've seen Madam Secretary, Ken? I've seen one mm-hmm. episode, and I enjoyed it.
Yeah, I do. Like I said, you know, it's a funny thing that my wife really enjoys that show, and so she watches it a lot. So I'll catch it sometimes if I'm doing work or whatnot through osmosis, and sometimes I'll put the laptop down and watch it with her. So I think it's a pretty interesting premise, and it's you know, Hollywood always has a special I guess take on things. What I will say is I like it because it does not seem to be biased. It just one way or the other. It just seems to deal with one crisis after another, and they pull in the family elements of it. And I will tell you, if there is something about shows that kind of put me off, it's like I really like to get into the meat of the substance and leave the whole family stuff out of it. And you can't do that. I get that. So there is a bit of drama in that show that goes in that direction with the kids and so forth, but and their adult children, I should say. But I do enjoy it. I like Tia Leone anyway. I've always thought her to be a very competent actress. She's got a very distinct voice and style about her that I find engaging.
And I love her in Jurassic Park 3 as well.
Jurassic, that's where you went. Well, at least you didn't say Bad Boys. Oh, was it Bad Boys too? I don't remember.
Yeah. Exactly. And then finally, we have another email from Brad Alexander. Pleasure as always to get your emails, Brad. Real quick, I know, Ken, you and Richard read one of his emails when I was gone. He mentioned the Way I Heard It podcast by Mike Rowe. And I actually listened to that podcast. It's a very, very fun, kind of bite-sized, untold story of history kind of podcast. And I recommend anybody listens to that who's interested in those sorts of things. I always find those stories interesting. The kind of angle they take on it is, you know, they tell you a story, but they don't tell you, like, who the character is. It's like, Barry did this, and Barry did that, and, you know, and then you know what Barry ended up doing? Becoming President Barack Obama. Well, that's the way I heard it, you know. So that's, it's, you know, these nicknames or some other kind of framing technique of the story to kind of like, oh, they got me on that too. I didn't see that one coming. So I highly recommend Mike Rowe's podcast. You know, I really like Mike Rowe. I like his his worldview on things, and always appreciate his point of view. So thanks for calling out that podcast, Brad. Speaking of, you know, Ken, you say we listen to other podcasts. That's one on my feed on a regular basis. But Brad sent us in another email, not to me, to you and Richard, because I was gone when he wrote this email, apparently. So he says, Brad says, hello, Ken and Richard. Now that I've gotten all that Honor Harrington stuff off my chest, that's a novel series he had mentioned in his last email, I had a few comments regarding the Battle of the Battles. Both were great, especially from a special effects perspective. I will first cover my gripes. First, on the Mutara Nebula battle, I had a complaint about the whole two-dimensional thinking thing. I agree. they were still fighting on the same plane. Yes, the Enterprise may have dived below the Reliant, but they were still fighting on the same plane. And if you remember, prior to Kirk's order, when they were searching for each other, there was one scene with the Enterprise passing well above the Reliant. Still, it was the same plane. And if it was Admiral Kirk's command to submerge the Enterprise, then she surfaced behind Reliant. If this had been truly a three-dimensional battle, I would think the Enterprise slashing upward from her Z-10,000 meters in a completely different plane, firing torpedoes and phasers straight into her belly, not unlike two fighter jets. The other thing that I find wrong with Spock's comment is that, were they not doing exactly the same thing? It is true. I mean, most Star Trek space battles are two-dimensional, and that's why, you know, when I think about this, there's two things that come to mind. One, two-dimensional thinking, that would imply, like, pre-air combat, right? Because any, you know, Khan was around the 1990s. They had airplanes back then. There's some three-dimensional thinking at work there. Yes, it's for smaller fighter jets and not like, you know, giant battleships, but the same concept does apply. And we've talked about this before. That was just them. They needed to simplify, like, okay, we're going to use Kirk's experience versus Khan's, you know, experience. And the whole thing is about, you know, even though Kirk's old, he's still got it, you know, and that's an advantage. And Kirk even says in the movie, the only reason we're alive is because I knew something that he didn't. And that they keep going back to that as far as Kirk versus Khan. But the other thing I think about is one of the few times I've actually seen them do this in Star Trek, and they probably did a lot more in Deep Space Nine because the Defiant's more maneuverable and there's lots of battles, but and all good things, when the Enterprise D2.0 like comes up from the bottom, you see it flying up, right. It's firing its big phaser cannon at that Klingon ship. I'm like, yeah, that's the way, that's dynamic space battles right there. So I think Star Trek has learned over time how to incorporate that, but I guess it's just odd. It would look odd if you had all these like ships like upside down and all this stuff, because there's no up or down in space, right? But they do it to frame for the movie screen, the TV screen, right? You can't have it. And in fact, these ships would get way too close to each other as well. By the way, they would not be this close fighting in a real battle of any kind. And he goes on to talk about the Khitmer battle. He says, now Khitmer. Star Trek has always had a kind of strange relationship with submarine combat. The cloaking device was their homage to subs. You can tell because even in this scene, Uhura says, quote, if she's out there, she's rigged for silent running. unfortunately, they never quite got it right. It is similar to World War II sub combat, where the submarine was at a definite disadvantage. Limited battery power, had to get visual, a periscope of range and bearing before firing, etc. Balance of Terror was an homage to the enemy below. Sub had to come up to periscope death, decloak to fire, and the Enterprise in firing unaimed photon torpedoes. I know they said phasers, but those are photons. Yes, in the original version, that's something the remastered version fixed. Was a tantamount to a depth charge attack. It's a good man, vocab, man. Good job, Brad. Pulling out the thesaurus there, man. Now, modern submarines do not have those limitations. They have nearly unlimited nuclear power. They're damn near as fast submerged as surface combatants, thanks to the teardrop hull design from the 1950s. They are nearly silent when submerged, and they can fire wire-guided, homing torpedoes that can track a target. I believe that Chang's prototype was a tip of the hat to modern submarine warfare. Now, I agree with you that while Spock is the smartest person in the room, I would think that there would be better qualified people than he and Uhura to come up with the concept of homing torpedo. And then he and McCoy to build it, especially in the tube. While McCoy's running commentary was typically acerbic, again with the vocab, Brad, very impressive, but charming. Really? The only thing that was missing was the, quote, I'm a doctor, not a fill-in-the-blank line. And that is not how R&D works. You invent a torpedo upgrade on the fly as it is sliding toward a tube. Yeah. I think my biggest issue with the Battle of Khitmer was the fact that they invented a homing photon torpedo, but then they forgot it. You never see it in any of the subsequent series. One other thing, if it was chasing exhaust, why did it hit the fore portion of the ship? Both
could have been the exhaust of the torpedo.
Both battles had glaring plot holes and tried to reinvent tech and tactics that have been around for 400 plus years. Now, having said all of that, the Mutara Nebula wins, Brad. So there you go, Brad. Thanks for that insightful email. It's very in depth, and I appreciate that, man. That's some good insight there. And you know, I kind of had some running commentary to that as well. But I think a lot of it, again, it comes down to it's a balance of like what's accurate and then what's going to look cool on screen. Because you know, at the end of the day, this is entertainment here. We don't want to, if we truly saw how two ships would fight, they would never be in the same frame. Or if so, like the camera, quote unquote, would have to be so far away you couldn't even see them. You know, I think of the space battle in Arena. You know, of course we don't see it very much because budget, right? But it's probably the most realistic because the Gorn ship is like out of visual range, and that's probably one of the more realistic fights the Enterprise ever got in, because they're not going to be like up on you like a fighter jet would like fly in real close. These are battleships that don't have to get that close. They would keep their distance. So space battles in Star Trek, you know, I mean, that's Star Trek's never been about the space battle, so it's never like, you know, stuff has never truly bothered me. But we've had some great ones, and you know, sorry to jump the timeline here, Ken, but I gotta say my favorite space battle in all of Star Trek is the battle at the beginning of First Contact with the Borg cube and the Starfleet, especially when the Enterprise swoops in and saves the Defiant. I was like, yeah, and they set the Enterprise theme. There's just, you know, emotional resonance there for me. So that's my favorite. It'd be sacrilegious here on Standard Orbit and mention the TNG film.
It's not sacrilegious. I think you spoke eloquently on how the tactics have evolved, and you know, in all good things, that was a great scene. First of all, Brad, great letter, and I'm so impressed with an Army guy knowing so much about submarine warfare. It's very, very impressive, actually. And all your points are spot on. I think one of the things that we get bent around the axle with Star Trek, and I do as well, to Brad's point, is they go to such extremes to explain through their pseudoscience and how things work in the 23rd century that when it actually comes to, I guess, warfare, they don't. you know, what's the difference between a photon torpedo or a quantum torpedo or range guidance systems, the ability to do things? I mean, there was a concept I saw in Voyager that had been talked about forever, which was, why aren't they just beaming the weapons in, right, and blowing them up from the inside out, which they actually do finally in a Voyager scene. And it's like, yeah, that you know, it was a holographic, I guess, simulation that they did. But at any rate, I think that's an area of weakness, to be honest with you, with the show. It's obviously meant to show some fun scenes and to give the audience some cool eye candy or whatnot. But it is weird that in outer space that they are two to 300 years ahead of us, depending on the movie, that the technology and their capabilities are less than what our warfare capabilities are today, and by a lot. And it just doesn't make a lot of sense. But it is fun to watch. And I would say that probably in Star Trek VI was probably the first time you saw a dynamic space battle, right? Because the Bird of Prey did attack the Enterprise from all angles, from above, from below, from side to side. It was all over the place, just given the trajectory of the torpedo. So they did get that right. But I agree with Brad. The better scene, the better battle scene played out was the Battle of the Mutara Nebula by far. Okay, we done?
Now we're done.
All right.
Well, they say revenge is a dish best served cold, and in Star Trek, it seems revenge is a dish best served again and again and again, because it's a trope in Star Trek, both in TOS and the movies, for revenge to be a driving force behind the plot. So that's what we're going to talk about today in our topic, Ken.
Yeah, it's interesting how this evolved society revenge is driven from our characters, or how our characters are drawn in to a revenge, you know, situation or a vengeance type of thing where one society's pitted up against another. But I would say that as we went down the list and we looked at all the episodes, and there's some that are kind of on the line, and we'll talk about that, if you look at 79 episodes, the number that it's a key part of the plot is actually somewhat limited. It's not that bad. It, obviously, when we get to the movies, that changes dramatically. I mean, it becomes like a 180 as far as their approach and things. And in some of the episodes as well, it is also a piece of it. The plot might not be wholly driven, or something happens within the episode to trigger that response. But I'm looking forward to diving into these, Zach. So let's go.
Yeah, this is a great suggestion, Ken. We came up with this idea, and as you said, I think a lot of, and that's what we examine here on Standard Orbit, kind of the pop culture misconceptions about, you know, Star Trek and Kirk and the original series, and the like as you said, the movies, the ratio is quite high, but the original series ratio is not so high. So the first one we have here is The Conscience of the King. When I was a kid, I didn't know the word conscience or how to spell it, so I had, you know, some Star Trek trading cards, and I always said The Conscience of the King until that's what I used to call this. But anyway, this is a great episode. It's a very odd episode, as far as it's not really any science fiction in it, you know. It's a very human drama. It's very appropriate that it's, you know, begins and ends with a Shakespeare play, because it's very Shakespearean in its story and its themes, and definitely it is a revenge. It's kind of a double-sided revenge story, because you have Kodos the Executioner, and spoilers, guys, for this 50-year-old show, his daughter is killing off any witnesses to the atrocities he's committed on Tarsus IV. I believe it was 20 years previous. Kirk was living there, and then also was our friend Lieutenant Kevin Riley was also there, so we have a couple people in the Enterprise, officers who are targets for Lenore, Kodos's daughter. And at this point, Kodos has kind of blocked it out of his memory, because it was such a bad experience, and he was basically, he's an analog for Hitler, you know. I mean, if you think about it, this is about 20 years after World War II. There are all these rumors that, you know, Nazis, perhaps even Hitler, had escaped Europe and moved to South America, and that's what was going on here. You know, this was a war criminal who had been escaping persecution. Interesting tie in there, because Shatner had been in the Judgment at Nuremberg movie, where they focus in on that. So there's a lot of themes that tie into this. But so Lenore wants revenge, basically for her father, because she felt wronged and all this stuff, to protect him, you know. So that's her angle. And then Kirk and Riley want revenge for Kodos, you know, slaughtering, you know, all the people that were in their colony there. Riley takes, you know, he actually, when he finds out about the truth, he takes matters in his own hands with a phaser, and he's going to go, you know, kill Kodos himself. Kirk has to grapple with this all episode, and then he has to balance it out with Spock and McCoy about, you know, what should he do? What's the responsible thing to do in his position? You know, obviously he has his emotional reaction, but he's a captain of a starship now, and a much older, mature man, and how do you deal with that? So there's a lot of good themes going on here in Conscience of the King, and it's one of those episodes that flies under the radar, but it's a really good one.
I think so. I like the whole, I guess, twist in it, that it wasn't just this guy acting like a barbarian. He was in a horrific circumstance. He made a terrible judgment. And the supply ships, right? I mean, the key to all of this was that their food supply was infected by a fungus, and people were going to starve to death. And in order to save at least a portion of it, this guy, Kodos, he had to decide who lived and died. And the irony is the resupply ships showed up much earlier than were anticipated, so none of the executions were necessary. And, you know, there's definitely a piece of this where you can tell it has impacted him as well, as far as, you know, that knowledge. And he's had to live with this horrible decision. So you've got that mix in it too, where it wasn't just an evil villain conducting these atrocities. It wasn't Hitler, right? It was definitely one of those things where in the plot line, the way it's written, is there's definitely two ways you could look at this, and how it's impacted people's lives. And I think that's what makes the writing in Star Trek so brilliant in that everything is not so darn black and white. Sometimes it is in these episodes, it is. But in this case, it wasn't. And I thought they did an excellent job. And it wasn't just revenge from one angle, right? It was the daughters. It was Riley's, it was Kirk's, it was Kirk's friend, it was all those things. And I found this episode to be one of the better ones that definitely does fly under the radar. But in its complexity and its cleverness, I would highly recommend, if it's something that you haven't seen in a while, see it, watch it again. It's really well done. It is not your typical revenge trope. There's a lot to this.
Absolutely. So the next one we have on our list is Arena. And this is one of those ones that are kind of on the line. You mentioned,
definitely
Ken.
On the line. Yeah.
I mean, we have a sneak attack on our Cessus III outpost by the Gorn, and then Kirk is kind of driven by revenge, sort of, but also like an obligation. I mean, he talks to Spock, and like they have a discussion about like, well, what should we do next? And he's like, well, the next step is invasion, so we have to stop this ship before they invade. So they go chasing after this Gorn ship, and that's kind of a motivating factor for Kirk, like, because, you know, the Gorn slaughtered everyone at this base, so he's, you know, it's fresh on his mind to get revenge for it. It's a very small element, I guess, in the grander scheme of things in the story, more story about misunderstanding and communication and mercy and lots of themes going on in Arena, one of, you know, the greatest episodes of Star Trek. The Citizen Kane is Star Trek, as it has been called on this podcast before, by other hosts. So that's the revenge element there, and, you know, a small component, but a component nonetheless.
It is. It's I guess it's kind of the reverse of it in a sense. They want to make sure that there's a deterrent, that the Gorn don't attack again, and make sure they understand that retribution would be swift, and that's why they're tracking down the ship. But at the very, very end, if it was truly a revenge plot, the Gorn would have died for vengeance of all the Federation folks that were killed. So I think that it is right on the line. I don't know if it's a revenge-driven episode. It's a misunderstanding, understanding. Again, what Star Trek does so well, it flips things. From another angle, it looks like the Federation are the invaders, and the Gorn are making extreme steps to make sure that they never invade
invaders,
again.
As yeah. I will destroy you. I love impersonating Ted Cassidy. It's like such a cool voice, but
yeah. But it was great episode, kind of revenge. Maybe I would not. That's why we put it on the list.
A lesson that revenge is not the answer, Ken. If anything's to be learned from this episode, so
yes. Or you could do it the way TNG does it. By being way over the top. Agreed. Anyway, we move on.
So, court-martial is another one focusing on revenge. This focuses on Kirk being framed for the death of his former friend, Ben Finney. He had called him out in years previously on a previous assignment on the Republic, and that had basically hurt Ben's career. While Kirk had ascended to captain, I believe Finney was just still a lieutenant at this point, so obviously he got stalled in the ranks because of this, and I guess Ben Finney, he was playing the long game here, because that was quite a few years ago, and he was the he is a computer officer on the Enterprise, and he reprogrammed the computer to fake some evidence that Kirk had ejected the the pod, which I always laugh about this episode, because why does Kirk have the eject pod button like on his on his arm chair, right? But we see him hit that eject pod button, and that seems like damning evidence, but in the computer records. But apparently, Ben Finney had programmed it that way to frame Kirk, bring down his career. They have a confrontation at the end. Ben is not dead. He had faked his own death. He'd been hanging out on the Enterprise in secret, waiting all this thing out. Classic Kirk fight in the episode saves the Enterprise. It's actually very similar to Space Seed, right? There's a fight in engineering that Kirk wins, and if he doesn't win it, the Enterprise will be destroyed. And of course, he's highly motivated to save his ship, and he does. So this is a case of like, this is a classic. Just like bad guy trope, like you wronged me 20 years ago, and I I haven't been able to let it go. Just complete exaggerated response to something that Kirk was just doing the right thing as a fellow officer, pointing out this guy's mistake. It's like, dude, let it go. Have a little self perspective, and you would have solved yourself a lot of problems. So,
well, what I think this really focuses on a little bit here is ethics, and how you approach something. So here was Ben Finney, and if I understand it was also an instructor at the academy. They became good friends at the academy. He was Kirk's senior officer. They're on the Republic. Kirk's making his rounds, I could see, with the clipboard, just like they do on any Navy ship. And something wasn't done that could have jeopardized the vessel. He reported it. They do the investigation. They find out it was Finney who unintentionally made this error. And just like a lot of today's modern Navy, zero defects. You know, you get one shot and you're done sometimes. I hope things are getting better. But it was, you're right, it was a bit over the top. But, you know, that note in his record caused him to not promoted as advanced. And you could see that when they finally meet up, that Finney's quite a bit older than Kirk.
Yeah.
And that Finney was at the rank of lieutenant commander while Kirk was a captain. So, yeah, it probably it kept Finney from moving up and wanting to probably pursue his dream of being a captain of a starship, which is obviously a very elite position. And what I'm talking about, the ethics piece of this is, you know, this is interesting. You are close friends, very, very close friends, and somebody screws up. And if it's fixable and no one needs to know, and the person could learn from it, what do you do, right? And in this case, it's a little ambiguous. Did Kirk know it was Finney? Or was he just reporting what he found when he was doing his rounds? And that's what gets interesting. I mean, this guy named his daughter after Kirk. So you know these guys were close. And usually, you know, in a lot of these circumstances, and I've seen it many times, if you find something that could be somewhat serious, but it's fixable, and you know the ramifications could be really powerful against a person's career or whatever reputation, and you know that the intent was not belligerent, it was benign, it was an accident, what do you do? And I find that aspect of it interesting, and one that I think could really be explored much more, because we really don't get a feel for it. Because you could like, oh, Kirk was just doing his duty. Okay, he was doing his duty, I get it. Did he have to go to that extreme, or did he not know it was Finney in the first place? And if he did, what would have happened? And I think that's a great ethics conversation to have as to doing, you know, something along the lines that could impact somebody's career like this. And you could see the impact was huge. I mean, Finney wasn't just sacrificing the Enterprise. He was sacrificing himself. There was no means of escape for Finney either in this. So he had reached the end, you know. And it's just a really, really good episode. I know the silliness now when we look at technology and the ability to manipulate data and all that other stuff. But still, I like the whole, you know, was it Cogsley? Was the
the books?
Yeah, and being able to face against the their accuser and all that other stuff. And so it was cleverly done, cleverly written. And I think, like I said, there's a bigger piece of this. If they had really explored the issue a little bit more, it would have been fascinating to me to find out if Kirk actually knew it was Finney who made the mistake. And the choice that he made there, because, you know, if your bestest friends with somebody does something like that, would you have done the same thing? And yeah, good moral ethics questions there. All right, I'm off on my tangent again. I'm back.
No, that's good. That's a good point, Ken. This episode has never been really one of my favorites. It's just been one of those middle of the road episodes. And I think you honed in on a good thread there that they really could have examined on, like, truly, like, who is at fault here and what did you do in that situation? And I think they got caught up in other things, like the computer being reprogrammed and all these sidetracks. Right. And had they just stuck to the story between Kirk and Finney, you know, the revenge thread, which we're talking about today, then that would have been a stronger piece. And maybe a more fondly remembered episode, because there's some good base elements there. But come on, guys, just let stuff go. If you get corrected at your job, take it in stride. Constructive criticism is a good thing. Just let's remember that.
a career-limiting decision is a little bit different there. I mean,
well, Star Trek, Starfleet is not a military organization, Ken.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
But
that's
moving
why
on.
They have people called lieutenant commanders and captains, and you follow rules and regulations.
They're humanitarian and peacekeeping armada. But moving on. The Doomsday Machine. All right, this is a very clear Moby Dick analog. It's Moby Dick in space is what it is, and it's very theatrical, but it's very appropriate. I mean, this guy's lost his entire ship and crew, and he's a broken man. We see him, I mean, we first meet him, he's just a broken man, and when he gets his hands on the Enterprise, takes command of that, he's like, he's going to, you know, avenge his ship and you know, because it's become personal to him now. Like, he's his but that's what's so interesting about this and Moby Dick, right? Because the Planet Killer, like Moby Dick, is just, it's a thing. It does its thing. It has no ego. It has no drive. It's just doing what it does, right? But the obsessed captain, being Ahab or Decker here, that they project all their anger and insecurities and brokenness onto this object. They fixate on it because it's like, oh well, you know, it's straight out of hell, you know. It's like, no, it's just a machine doing its thing, you know. So he puts the Enterprise in jeopardy trying to get his revenge on the Planet Killer for destroying his ship and killing his crew. Fortunately, the Spock is able to take back command of the Enterprise and rescue it. And Kirk on the Constellation is also able to lure it away from the Enterprise. Otherwise, Decker and his new crew on the Enterprise would have suffered the same fate as Ahab and Moby Dick. So this is one of the clearest A to B translations of the Moby Dick themes, which you see a lot throughout the rest of the Star Trek canon.
Okay, I'm drawing my sword, Mr. Moore.
Okay,
because I don't agree with that. Funny as it, you know, I don't discount what you're saying as far as the
obvious cases, and you're like, I disagree.
I disagree, and why do I disagree? Two reasons, and people use the Moby Dick, and Star Trek uses the Moby Dick, you know, Ahab scenario all along. The one thing that I think is missing from both this and even in First Contact a little bit when they say Ahab and the White Whale and Vengeance and all that other stuff is when you read Moby Dick, you're talking about a species that's being slaughtered by man that has angered the whale, and the whale is, you know, is fighting back, right? So we're the antagonists. In both these cases, the Doomsday Machine is a weapon, and it's a real threat to the Federation. What happens to Commodore Decker is exactly what happens to Ahab. But I think there is a big distinction where, also with the Borg. The Borg are antagonists. They want to take over everything, and so the obsession to stop them because of the larger threat that they have, I think, is a piece of it where it is not in Moby Dick, where this guy's just pissed. He lost, you know, Ahab, you know, he lost his ship, he lost his crew, he lost a lot of things, and he's after this whale because this whale is fighting back. And that's I guess the biggest distinction I have with the Moby Dick analogy. The humans in Moby Dick are the bad guys all the way around. Moby Dick, the whale itself, he's just fighting to live. He's fighting to save his species.
Well, see, I never took that angle on it. I just thought it was like nature being nature, you know. And I felt all the projections were from the humans, you know, bad guys or good guys alike. Like, oh, this whale is evil. It's like, well, no, it's just a whale. It's just doing its thing, you know. And you're just getting in its way. I mean, that was my
take. That's fair. I just look at the Doomsday Machine as they got to stop this thing, and Decker being so focused on its destruction, he's looking at what they have to do, but not at the how to do it, and just getting taken away. He's just, you know, what failed him in the past, right? The definition of insanity certainly applies. If you're just going to keep shooting at it and it has no impact, that's not how you're going to destroy this thing. And that's where you're right. He is so obsessed with revenge, it clouds his mind and focus, and then kind of comes up with, you know, his own death spiral kind of opens the idea as to how they could really kill it. And I think they do a good job of it. It's a great episode. I think the performance in this episode is phenomenal. And I really love the updated one where it isn't just the model, AMT model off the shelf that they put in there. Because it is weak as far as, you know, the Galileo and the Constellation are exactly the same size as they approach the opening to the mod of the ship.
Right.
And I get on that, you know, again, it's not about the special effects in the original series, but I do see that Ahab like approach and behavior is exactly the same. This guy is just like, I'm going to take us all down for the sake of revenge and not accomplish his goal. And that's the tragedy of it.
Yeah, that is the worst. It's like, look, if you're going to go down guns blazing and, you know, in a blaze of glory and accomplish your goal, that's one thing. But if you're going to sacrifice everybody and it makes no impact, that's like the greatest tragedy of them all. So.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Same thing in Wrath of Khan, right? We'll get to that later, but obsession.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of my another one of those episodes that not a lot of people talk about, but I thought was brilliant in concept and plot. Right? I don't know about you, but I really really enjoyed this episode.
Again, it's going back to Kirk's past, delving into it, much like Court Martial. But this one, I think they honed in on more of a stronger central theme with it, and obviously any sense of revenge and revenge and obsession are connected, right? Because if you truly, you know, want to take revenge on something, it's an obsession for you. Without obsession, revenge would just fade away. And they're very appropriately titled Obsession, as Kirk wanting revenge on this cloud creature that killed lots of his crew and his captain back when he was on the Farragut. So again, delving into Kirk's past. He was the main character of TOS, so we get a lot more backstory with him than almost any other character, you know, other than Spock a little bit. But there's lots of story elements to be mined here, because he'd been in Starfleet for years and he had lots of experiences. And I think pulling back on these things, it really adds more shades to his character and shows that he's not a perfect guy. But with the help of his friends, he can accomplish anything. Right? That's that charmulative of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. You know, much like in *Conscience of the King*, right? They got to talk about this, and they call him out on stuff. I like it when Kirk and when Spock and Bones have to like team up against Kirk. It's like, look, man, if you know we're on the same side here, we got a point. So you need to chill.
Right. No, you're right. Revenge spawns obsession to the point of destruction. Mm-hmm. Although they do figure out this one, but at a cost.
Right. Well, even at the end, Kirk is willing to sacrifice himself, not in an obsession way, but just, you know, because there's Farragut, Captain Garavik. Right. Those names are too similar. Captain Garavik on the Farragut. But his son is a security officer, and Kirk, that's an extra layer of guilt because he feels like, oh, man, I got this guy's, you know, father killed due to my, you know, inability to react. And Kirk is going to sacrifice himself at the end, but Garavik's going to, you know, doesn't. And, it shows that, you know, you can still have the self-sacrifice. I mean, you know, as we see many times in Star Trek, you can have the self-sacrifice to the good end. Unlike, you know, Commodore Decker was doing the self-sacrifice at the cost of everyone else with no regard for anyone else's safety or life. But Kirk's was a completely selfless attempt at self-sacrifice at the end of this episode. Again, driven by his obsession, but used in a good way.
Right. I agree. So, ready for the next one?
Yeah, the next one. Let That Be Your Last Battle Feel. Now, this is actually one of my favorite episodes of the third season, and probably one of the most iconic. Like, people are like, oh, yeah, the guys with the white and black faces, right? And it really, it is about revenge. It's about racism. It's about, you know, obsession and all these, like I said, all these emotions that have been tying together, because it's an analog for, you know, race relations, and it shows the absurdity of it all. But because of the history that Bell and Lokai have with each other, they can't let go of this hatred and this vengeance they want to take out on each other. Like, they can barely not, you know, get in fisticuffs whenever they're standing next to each other. They grapple with each other at almost every opportunity without being interrupted by the crew. And, you know, had they been able to just let go of their, you know, built-in, you know, baked-in vengeance at this point in their lives, that they could have moved on. But they were so far into their hatred and their racism and their need for vengeance on each other. Now Bell would call it justice, because Lokai is a, quote, criminal. But it really is. It's just racist revenge is what it is. And they bring them to the planet. The planet is in ruins. That's still not going to stop them. They're still going to chase each other forever. And they live for thousands and thousands of years, apparently. So this revenge need has been baked into them for millennia, and yeah, it's a sad ending. So you can see where revenge and hatred and racism will take you for these two characters. So,
yeah, I think that sometimes the reason for the killing gets lost. Right, there was a seed, there was an element, racism being the one in this one that creates the violence. And then the violence creates the revenge, because you killed a bunch of my people, now I'm going to kill a bunch of your people. And it all comes down to who's going to be the bigger ones to say, this has got to stop holistically. And it never does, right? And it ruins the whole planet. So it was that whole revenge mindset, that obsession of, I've got to get this guy because he has blown up, or he's done whatever he's done. And no one's looking at the key issue, which was... the whole thing, the whole reason was just ridiculous in the first place. Now, human nature being what it is, there is so many ridiculous reasons for war and fighting and all that other stuff today. It's incredible. It's nuts. And ideologies have become so obsessed and polarized now. I look at the last battlefield in our own society now, and it's a lot less about race as much as it is about how you think and how somebody else's think, and the intolerance that we have towards people being able to look at things in two different ways. So I see this whole thing playing out actually very, very quickly.
Just as relevant now as it was in the 60s for sure.
It's different. You know, it's changed course. It's no longer the color of your skin. It's whether your ideology is one way or another. And that's what's crazy about it, and it's just as silly.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the brilliant thing about this episode. Yeah. They make it so idiotic. You're like, oh, well, that's the reason, really. And I want to say that you can obviously hide your revenge behind, you know, being in the right. You know, like Bell, he's a police officer, right? And he's like, this man's a criminal, and you know, he's obsessed. He's chased him across the whole galaxy looking for him. I was like, man, you're going a little above and beyond in your job. It's a bit like Les Mis, right? You know, with Javert and Russell Crowe and Hugh Jackman. No, Javert and John Valjean, you know, stealing a loaf of bread and all this stuff and just obsessing over this guy. It's like, look, I probably did some bad things, but as you said, they were in response to bad things, and who started this cycle, and who knows, right? I mean, as you said, they've forgotten at this point. All they have is their hate and their need for revenge. But you know, it's interesting when anyone can, like, justify their revenge, like, oh well, I'm just doing my job, he's a criminal, I gotta bring him in, you know. I think you're going a little too far with this guy. So there are so many themes in this episode beyond just what's, you know, on the surface, which is, you know, kind of the point as well. So
yeah, and I think that's why a lot of people, oh, it's too on the nose. Well, there's subtleties to it when you back away a little bit, and you know, it gets the message across about racism, it gets the message across about hate. It also gets the message across that both sides, in order to be successful, have to let go at some point. And it's a tough one, right? Because it's not human nature. It really isn't. And it really is difficult. And I think, you know, you look at the, you know, it all comes down to when people are just tired of fighting and dying, and which side is going to just say, okay, this is crazy, we got to stop this. So anyway, on to the next one.
On to Turnabout Intruder. Now, this episode,
your favorite episode, right?
Now, number one, favorite episode
of all time.
I don't think it. You know, I don't think it's as awful as other people would say. I think there is some merit to it. Some interesting stuff here. But I mean, it is a revenge story. It's a jilted ex-girlfriend. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And Janice Lester is seriously scorned, and she has had, and talk about letting stuff go, right? We're talking about Ben Finney from X amount of years ago, whatever. She knew Kirk at the Academy, and they did not work out, and she has not let this go. And I'm not sure if she was seeking out a machine like this, or she just happened to find one and was like, oh, yes, I know exactly what I'm going to do with this. But, you know, she discovers the body-swapping machine, swaps with Kirk, takes over his life. The whole subtext of it is, unfortunately, like, oh, women can't be captains. That's such a point of debate. It's been people have been debating that for 50 years now about what that means. And, you know, Starfleet was truly, you know, sexist in that way. I feel like the recent episode of Star Trek Continues, The Winds of Change, actually covered that very well. If anyone wants to delve into that subject a little more. But Janice Lester, she feels wronged by Kirk as a lover, as, like, Starfleet by an organization. I mean, she's got a lot of, you know, things to take revenge on, and she does, and, you know, sure, it's a little, in some parts, a little campy, but I actually, it's very entertaining to see Shatner play a woman playing him, you know, like, it's actually pretty good acting. People will laugh at it, but he changes a lot of things, and really inhabits the presence of that, and also very unhinged, right? Because she's revenge minded. Like, she goes on these tantrums. You know, she's clearly not all right in the head, and that all, again, stems from obsession and vengeance.
It does. I agree with you. It's not as bad an episode as people think it is. Or if you watch it enough, there's a lot of nuances in it, I think, that you know, will drive behavior that needs to be examined more closely. I also think that this is where it gets difficult for me, because none of us want to think or believe that Starfleet would keep a woman from helming the ship in this advanced society and whatnot. And there's been a lot of, I think you know, they say the writer screwed up when that comment was made.
The writer, Gene Roddenberry, being in there, getting writing credit, which is always amusing. People's like, oh no, this is not Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. We actually wrote this episode, guys, so I'm just saying.
That's what I'm saying. It's crazy. But, you know, sometimes, you know, it's one of those things. I think it's a low point as far as this advanced society thinking in this way that a woman cannot be a captain of a starship. Now, in the 60s, women weren't allowed to serve on warships, period. So, you know, they might have been looking at it, hey, at least they're serving on warships, but, you know, they're not capable of leading it. I don't know. I think it's a shame that piece of Star Trek culture, you know, it's, like we said, if it's on screen, it's real. It doesn't matter what backdoor memos were made behind the scenes or whatever, that it shouldn't have happened or it didn't happen. It happened, and it was said, and unfortunately, you know, in this universe, I guess we have to assume that that women can't be starship captains at that time. Now, obviously, in Enterprise, they ignored it, as they should have, and women were was it Rodriguez? Was it Captain of the Columbia or something like that?
Something like that.
I forget her name. Yeah, but anyway, so I think that they ignore it, they blow it off as they should. I think that's the right thing to do, but it did happen, and you know, the person who wrote it was sexist. There's no other way to say it. By writing that line, mm-hmm. they certainly were not engaged or aligned with the Star Trek universe as it was meant to be. So that's it. That's said. That's done. And she has a right to be ticked off.
Yeah, I was going
to
say.
She's over the top. Yeah, she's over the top, but she has a right to be ticked off.
I question her methods and her response to it, but I would be angry, too, if I were her in her situation. So.
Yeah, and I also wonder, too, if back, it wasn't until the early 1980s that women were allowed to go to the Naval Academy, right? So that's not all that long ago, and I wonder for women who joined the Navy, and you know, like we all know, a lot of people know of Admiral Grace Hopper, right, who essentially came up with all the kind of computer programming methods that became the foundation for today's technology, and she was a brilliant person and obtained the rank of admiral, I think, first female admiral, somewhere in the 1960s, and was around until the 1980s and 1990s. But she was a specialist, you know, she wasn't going to be captaining a ship or anything, but I do wonder for women that joined the service before they had, the ability to obtain they could obtain rank, but they couldn't obtain certain positions. Still the same today in some combat areas. Fascinating to me that, you know, she went in, you would think, to Starfleet Academy with her eyes wide open to what the limitations were, unless, Gene Roddenberry, the fictional one in Starfleet, decided that at some point, no, women aren't capable. They can be executive officers, but not commanding officers. Just the whole premise of that is just ridiculously silly, and that's why I do write it off as far as Star Trek canon goes, but it's real.
Well, I mean, maybe they just wanted to add another element to it beyond just the jilted girlfriend thing, you know, because I guess that would be a little cliche, just the jilted mm-hmm. girlfriend. Now, if you were just a jilted girlfriend, would you really want to do the Freaky Friday body swap with your ex-boyfriend? I mean, that's the key. That's why she wants to become Kirk, right? And maybe,
right.
I feel like, you know, to maybe give them a little credit, they were just like, okay, we want a body swap to happen. We got to find a reason for it. And that was, mm-hmm. like, the only reason they could come up with at the time. But, hey, look, it was at the very, very, very tail end of the show. They were, you know, on fumes at this point. Everybody was like down about the being canceled. They just need to get some episodes out. And again, not as bad as people say, as his reputation precedes it. I feel like if this was not the last broadcast episode, it would not get the, like, oh, Turnabout Intruder garbage, right? It's like, well, I mean, yeah, not one of the greatest, but not complete garbage. And like I said, her revenge had a little bit of, you can understand where she's coming from, basically. So
yes, absolutely. Okay, we move on
to the movies.
To the movies.
So the Wrath of Khan. Wrath of Khan's success is a double-edged sword, right? It's brilliant. It's a great film. One of the best Star Trek films. I most consider it the best Star Trek film. It very well may be. Maybe not my favorite, but it's my second favorite. but definitely one of the best. The revenge template here, we see repeated so much in the movies. As we were talking about, the ratio to the movies for Revenge is so high, and even, you know, getting beyond, I mean, no pun intended, but beyond the TOS movies and Kelvin movies, the Next Generation movies, like I said, like all of them are just like this. Like the template is there. And yeah, I mean, we saw what happened to Khan at Space Seed. He got marooned on City Alpha 5 by Kirk. Things did not, you know, when they left him there, planet was okay. You know, it wasn't a wasteland. It wasn't terrible. He didn't drop him off on Tatooine or something. Come back 15 years later, we find out City Alpha 6 exploded 6 months after they were left there. So they were, it was a pretty tough ecosystem there for 15 years, you know. And I would be mad if I were Khan too. But at the same point, it's like, dude, you kind of put yourself in the situation. Not so much. I mean, obviously, you wanted to take over the Enterprise and take over, you know, get back to your mission of, you know, taking over because you felt like, you know, you were superior and therefore you had the right to rule over people, which is not a good attitude to have. Did you deserve to be dropped off in the middle of nowhere? I don't know. I mean, at that point, like, hey, you committed mutiny and we're going to, like, kill the captain and the crew and all this stuff. And so you got to look at, like, how you even got here, man. And, I don't know. I feel like obviously it's an unfortunate situation. City Alpha 6 exploded, but that's not Kirk's fault, you know. I mean, yes, Kirk put him on the planet, but he did it because Khan tried to kill him and take over his ship. So you understand Khan's point of view. If you're in that situation, you'd be mad too. It's just, again, projecting all of your frustrations of your circumstance on like the one thing you can fixate on, and that was Admiral James T. Kirk.
Right, as Yoa Kim pointed out. You have a starship to do what they want, and a very powerful device. So, you know, they could create a lot more havoc and have a lot more power and do a lot more things. And yet, Khan won't let Kirk go, and that eventually is his undoing, as it usually is. Very much akin towards Ahab. Mm-hmm. Of course, he actually sputters the same lines as Ahab and as Kirk, he goes down with his ship.
Kirk is the whale in the situation, so.
That's right, that's right. So, yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's. How do you take a movie whose original title was The Vengeance of Khan and not say it's not a revenge episode? So, that's key there.
Well, there's always that one guy, like the henchman, like the voice of reason, right? Like you said, Joachim there. And he's like, hey, I think you've proven that you're better than Kirk. We escaped our exile. Let's go live our lives. Because they have the Genesis device. They can go shoot it at a planet, make a world for themselves, which they wanted all along, right? Like, but that's all off the table now. Khan is completely fixated on Kirk, and he's not the same guy. You know, he was a very sophisticated, put together guy in Space Seed. You know, but here he's a broken man. He's warped. You know, these years of exile, the death of his wife has warped his superior intellect, and where he can just be goaded into following Kirk into a tactically compromising situation. I mean, they could have just waited it out. You know, Reliant could have waited it out for Enterprise, but no, Kirk's like, hey, on the comm system, that's all you need. Basically, calling him chicken. You know, calling him out. He gets to go in the Mutara Nebula, and that's all she wrote there. So.
Because your unguided torpedo missed.
There it is. Graphic Khan, the quintessential Star Trek revenge story for sure. We don't really need to go into any more detail there. We all know what it's all about.
We're good there.
Star Trek 3, what's the revenge angle here, Ken?
I took it from a Klingon's point of view a little bit there that, you know, they're not too happy with the direction the Federation's going. And, you know, I know they were going out to kind of preserve their race, I guess became a piece of it. But towards the end, you know, you have Kirk's son being killed. You know, the Klingons being so brutal in this episode kind of created that revenge factor as well. Although I'm not saying that Kirk killed Krug because of that. Krug was so focused on having that weapon and that power. So it might have been more of an obsession than a revenge type of thing. But the death of Kirk's son definitely impacts future movies in the way people think, or the way Captain Kirk thinks about the Klingons. And though there is never a stated, I'm going to get back at them, there's definitely a reluctance to want to work or trust them because of it. So I think it might have been a plot point that manifests itself more in future movies than it does in this one, because it's spoken about in 5 a little bit. Definitely 6, it's a big piece. And, we'll see where it goes from there. So, again, it's kind of like the IMUD or piece of the action. There's elements of it. It's not a revenge-based film by any means.
Yeah, as you said, this thread goes on to Star Trek 6, which would be our next one on our list here. And again, much like, you know, Conscience of the King, or obsession. This is focusing on Kirk's need for revenge. It's a beneath the surface revenge. It's like a subconscious need for revenge against the Klingons for him, because I mean it's not on the surface. It's not very present. But when Spock's like, "Hey, we should help these guys," he's like, "No, we shouldn't." You know, and then that's where that comes from the death of his son. He even makes his personal log about it, which they use against him in his trial. Very damning evidence there. But you know, this one is about overcoming revenge and letting that stuff go, right? But that's why Kirk can continue on and characters like Khan cannot, because they can't let it go. He puts his prejudices aside and they save the day. And then at the same time, you know, the Klingons have their own kind of sense of revenge. Azit Bur, you know, her father has been killed, and that's why she hates Kirk and all them, because she thinks they're responsible for the death of her father. And so they come to reconciliation at the end on a micro level, and that helps in reconciliation on a macro level for the Klingons and the Federation. So it's a great kind of redemptive story about revenge and the power of letting it go.
I agree. And I think that's what makes it such a great movie, and it harkens back to what we were talking about before with Let That Be Your Last Battlefield. Until the two sides agree that the killing has to stop, or the behaviors are self-destructive for both, nothing changes. And when you take the personal element of it into account, and I cannot speak and have not walked in a person's shoes where somebody has had somebody lost due to someone's actions, and you have to face that. But you know, I remember Gene Roddenberry saying he hated Star Trek VI because of the racism and the bigotry that was displayed. I think there's an element there that if your very own son is killed by a race or a group of folks that are known to be militant, very less tolerant, and I guess focused on expansionism, like the Klingons are, there's some quote unquote justification in your head. You know, it's like if they did something stupid, you know, if they overmined because they were trying to develop more weapons and to continue to build their arsenal for conquering other worlds, and it goes south on them and bad things happen, you got to think there's a piece of you in that dark spot in your heart that goes, yes, this will finally stop them. And then, well, wait a minute, what do you mean you want to help? You want us to help them? What, are you crazy? You know what these people want to do? Do you know what they've done? Do you know the damage that they have caused? And so it takes a lot of reflection and an understanding that for all of us, right? The big lesson there is you can't paint with a broad brush. There's good and evil in all aspects, and you've got to seek out that good. And I do believe that there is pure evil out there, don't get me wrong, but I do not think that pure evil is within every society. There's good and bad, and I think that's what Star Trek VI does so well, is it reaches deep into Gorkon's heart. He realizes, kind of like Gorbachev did, that they can't keep going in the same direction. It's not good for the people. It's not good for the overall society. In this case, it's not good for the Federation, and it's not good for the Klingons to keep going in this direction. And it's the people that are so afraid of change that cannot that keep pushing it back. So I think that this is a great story element that looks at the drives for revenge, and as you, I think, so eloquently put it, Zach, says, wait a minute. We can't keep going in this direction. We've got to stop. And I've got to forgive and let go in order for the greater good to happen. And I think both Azit Bur and Kirk do that wonderfully at the end of this movie.
Absolutely. So, Star Trek 09, mm-hmm. Vengeance story, Nero.
100%.
Yep. Again, this is the Wrath of Khan template. I know I give the TNG movies a hard time for like, oh, are you guys just copy and paste this template? Well, it looks like, Kelvin Timeline's a little guilty of it as well.
A little.
Every movie.
Every movie.
So, yes, obviously Nero is Khan, old Spock is Kirk, rinse, repeat, you know. Nero, one of the weaker villains, just because he's underdeveloped. They had so much to do in this movie as it was. They had to set up the new universe. They had to set up all the new characters, the new crew, introduces to them, get them in their proper positions, you know, that on the Enterprise, right? Nero is almost an afterthought here. So his vengeance feels kind of shallow. And then since we don't have a proper context, it's like, dude, Spock was trying to help you, man. What's your problem? Like, I just, again, he's a broken man. He's lost his family. He's lost his world. He's seen his whole planet be destroyed. He focuses in on Spock because Spock was supposed to prevent this, but like, look, you can't fault the guy for not succeeding. I mean, he was trying, You know, if he was just like, if he was just like turned his back on you guys and said, hey, it's gonna be fine, guys, don't worry about it, or, you know what, screw you, I'm gonna do better things. But he was actively trying to save Romulus with the red matter. So I thought that would get him some credit, but not Nero's eyes. And he's just fixated on Spock. And then that becomes a just completely absurd obsession, much like, you know, Khan just goes off the deep end. Nero, they get a second chance at life. They go in the past. They could go back to Romulus and help them prepare for this, you know? But instead of doing that, he just wants to go around destroying every other Federation planet, which is a little extreme overreaction, I think, on Nero's part.
Well, he wants them to feel the same pain he did, so that's the way he's driving it. And I don't know if the character's underdeveloped. I think the scale and scope of the destruction, and that's the funny thing that can get away from us in these universes, so to speak, or in these plot lines, is just how big, right? I mean, if you're talking about planetary destruction of, you know, enormous scale, billions and billions of lives gone, and, you know, here's the Federation, and in this case Spock saying, we have the technology to save you, we're going to come and do it now. You know, the one Star Trek 09 is such a good movie to me, in so many aspects. But there's two aspects where I think it falls short. One is this revenge story, but it does allow for everything else to kind of happen, and allows for that incredible drama on Vulcan, right? And it's pretty powerful. But, you know, the whole thing about a star going supernova and the ability to stop it just doesn't make any sense, right? As soon as if our sun increased by a small percentage, Earth is doomed. It's like doomed because we're going to bake
right
long before the star reaches our atmosphere. And of course, they actually show the star like right outside of Romulus. So like, it's like, well, they're already cooked, dude. They're cooked long before Spock could get
perhaps
there.
Perhaps they have
you
a planetary shield of some kind, Ken, like in Spaceballs. You know,
that's right. That's right. That could be, you know. But when the star disappears, then what? it's just one of those things where, you know, it was done quick and it's to serve a plot, and I know it's all pretend, but sometimes those little things get me. But it's Nero's character, based on his enormous loss, and it seems like that he may be the last of his kind. I do get the way that can impact somebody. You know, rational thought goes out the window, and it does in this case. And of course, then you add what is also in the movie or in the script, but we don't see, is the 20 years of imprisonment and hard labor. So not only does he lose his planet, but he's thrown in jail for a long time. You know, hard labor for 20 years. That is not conducive to healing and repairing one's soul.
right. I mean?
And I think sometimes those elements in J.J. Abrams' quest for a fast-paced movie, if a couple things, and I've heard Matthew Rushing say this a few times, if you let things breathe a little bit, it's okay if it adds to an understanding of the character. And I think Nero's character could have even been more understood, because when he showed up in the Federation, he's like, where is Ambassador Spock? Where is this guy? What happened? And then 20 years later, he's on his way to Vulcan to destroy it. So it's interesting there. But, you know, then you flip it to, and I think we can get through these next two pretty quick. Mm-hmm. You get into darkness. It's Khan. It's the Wrath of right. Khan all over again. The revenge factor is being used. And
Against RoboCop, case, not Kirk, yeah.
Yeah, in this case, it's the rest of Khan's crew that he thinks has been killed. And, you know, you push the wrong button with him. You have enhanced ambition with his enhanced physiology on top of all this, his enhanced sense of vengeance, and he's going to take you out. And that's exactly what happens. And again, it wasn't, was it necessary? Could have been done a lot better? I think so. I think they had something. I think they had, you know, let's take the whole Benedict Cumberbatch Khan thing and all that element out of it. Let's just look at it. Could they have done a lot more with this movie? They could have. Again, if they had put the right pacing in, if they allowed things to breathe, if they, you know, didn't make it about, you know, jumping technology barriers we'd never
seen.
I do
like the conversation it starts, right? Because, you know, Pike is killed and Kirk goes on a mission of vengeance to, you know,
right?
to get him. And, you know, Spock and him have this conversation where Spock pretty much convinces him, like, you know, just flat out murdering this guy is not the answer. We got to, you know, bring him in and face justice, you know. And that's a good dilemma. That's why I think the movie, it starts so strong and then it just kind of gets a notch lower as the movie continues. It kind of delves into, you know, cliches and sci-fi action and you know, rehashed old movies. But the beginning is very strong, and the questions that it poses about, you know, vengeance and justice and terrorism and what's our response to that. And even at the end, it's a very hopeful, much like Star Trek VI, Into Darkness is a very hopeful message at the end with Kirk's monologue. You know, that's not who we are. You know, we're Starfleet, we're better than that. So, despite some missteps along the way, I overall, the theme and the message of the movie is true.
Yeah, it's definitely a revenge-plotted film from two or three different angles, and like I said, it's one of those movies that had so much potential and just didn't quite live up to it. But one movie that I think did live up to its potential was Beyond. And we're not really sure what's driving this vengeance throughout the movie until, you know, we kind of learn the identity of who the villain is. But it was really cleverly done, I thought. And it pulled in a couple of universes that you haven't seen in Star Trek before, as well, you know, as well defined. And that was pulling in the Enterprise TV show era into it, and they did a good job with it. But Krull, his whole, you know, feeling cast aside and pushed away after fighting, you know, tremendous amount of wars and battles and all this stuff. I mean, he's a classic PTSD. Who's able to kind of take the fact that they weren't being rescued, and kind of being sent away without really dealing with the after effects of what war does to an individual, is a very relevant subject for today. It really is. If you look at the amount of suicides and things that we're dealing with, you know, it's a very real issue. And the revenge piece of it, of, you know, you don't get this, and unity, maybe a little bit too on the nose with fighting that unity or smashing down barriers and all this stuff is not the way to go, because all he saw was, you know, every time they opened a door, there was a bad guy behind it trying to take him out. So it definitely went into an extreme there. But, you know, still, it's to me, it's in my top five of all time Star Trek movies. And I thought it was brilliantly done. Again, it would be nice if in Star Trek IV or the next one that they do, they kind of go the way that Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home went, which was, you know, two movies in a row with a lot of violence and heaviness, with obsession and revenge kind of being in the middle, and to create a plot line where there's real threat and there's real tension, but they come together and they find a way to win. And I'd love to see that in the next Star Trek movie.
Yeah, did we need revenge here and beyond? Probably not. I think a lot of the speculation was, oh, this is going to be like an ideological thing, right? The Federation has some ideologies, and it's, you know, manifest destiny and all that, and then Krall and whatever his, you know, stance is in against that on an ideological level. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's different. But no, it became revenge story. But they did so well. It was so well executed. Like, that, I didn't mind. You know, I know before the movie came out, I was like, I hope they don't do some stupid twist with the villain like they did with Khan. I didn't like that. And then they did this exact thing, but it worked out because it opened up a whole nother avenue of conversation and revelations about his character and the Captain Edison and all the stuff you were talking about, PTSD and all that, and dealing with that. Now, I know that's a trope you're kind of sick of, like, and on a deeper level of revenge, like, oh, look, a soldier who can't let go of the military is going on, you know, he's off the reservation, so to speak, right?
Yep. No, I think what a lot like you, Zach, when I was seeing the previews and getting an understanding of what this was before we understood the whole Edison plotline, was just that, you know, the Federation type culture trying to engage another culture that was like, everything you do is wrong, and they switched the lens, and it didn't have to be a revenge movie. I think that would have been better, and I wish they had gone in that direction, because that happens all the time. I mean, that's Osama bin Laden right there. You know, we don't want your Western culture of values in this area. We want you out. And that's what created the Al-Qaeda. Everything else was based on that, right? They did not want secularism. They don't want other religions and societies messing with their extremist point of view. And that's where I thought it was going to go. And I thought that would have been just as interesting and just as timely. And it didn't. So that's a shame. But, you know, one thing it did allow us to, that it allowed it to do, and which would have been a real hard one to kind of pull in, was, like I said, pulling in the Franklin in that era of Star Trek,
right,
which also brought in a lot of smiles and happiness, and a lot of people really enjoyed that piece of it. So, you know, maybe you had to sacrifice one to get the other, and it was a win-win. Don't know.
Absolutely. All right, Ken, well, I think we've all had some hot takes on Revenge here, but you know what? Revenge is a dish best served cold, and that's not the only thing we've been talking about this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Family? We are her family, not you. He gets upset at Archer, like, you're stealing my daughter. Is she Hoshi Archer now? What is going on? What are you talking about?
Daughter? What's a daughter? What's a family?
And then he asks Archer to call back in the afternoon. Like, yeah, maybe by 3 p.m. everything will make sense.
Standard orbit.
I don't know why, but my first reaction to time travel is, oh no, don't do it. Don't do it. And I don't know if a lot of people feel that way. The good news is that whenever Star Trek does it, normally they execute it really well.
Warp 5.
So we need to hire some samurai to defend us. So they go out looking for some samurai, and they find a group of
about 7 of them.
Yeah, like 7 samurai who are, you know, maybe down on their luck.
The 602 Club.
But there are two moments, and I realize, you know, we've just started recording. We're already sort of derailing our own show here to just throw out all these great thoughts and memories and moments. But there are two moments in this movie that I had completely forgotten about, because I think if you haven't seen this in a few years, and this is probably the Bond movie I've seen more than any of the other movies, maybe with the exception of Goldfinger.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcast. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm.com/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page, or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at trekfm or on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and of course in the Babel Conference. Type Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek FM and click discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron on the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find the current goals and different milestone contributions along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details on patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our great associate producers for Standard Orbit. We have Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elrod.
Yes, thank you guys so much for your support for both Standard Orbit and Trek FM. So, Ken, if people want to find you out there on the internet, where can they find you?
You can find me hanging around the Babel Conference and engaging people when I have the opportunity. You can also find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @BostonSCPO, and we like to tweet out all our new episode information as soon as we get it, as well as our colleagues. So look for me there.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreOnZach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman series from the early 2000s. And you can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. So thanks, everyone, for listening. And join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.